I'm Duncan MacLeod, and you're watching TCS Plus, the business technology show from Tech Central, brought to you today by ESET. Now, Adrian Stanford is my guest today, all the way from Cape Town. Adrian is Group Chief Technology Officer at ESET Southern Africa. Adrian, it's good to see you. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Duncan. It's great to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure. ESET, interesting company. I was having a look at your Wikipedia page a little earlier today. Founded in 1992 in Bratislava, Slovakia. Tell me a bit about ESET and its history. Is it still headquartered in Slovakia?
Yes, Duncan, it actually is. And it's actually a really interesting story that I quite like to tell because it goes back even further than 1992. It actually goes back as far as 1981. So if you can picture this, it's the early 80s, and we're in communist Czechoslovakia, of course. And these two programming enthusiasts meet at a computer club, Peter Paschko and Miro Trinka. They're the original founders of ESET. And, you know, these guys are just exchanging ideas about building simple apps and exchanging, you know, those old 5 1/4 inch floppy disks to have a look at what they're doing. And after a couple of years, they meet some guys who work at a nuclear power plant, and they start sharing stuff between them as well. And one day, Peter phones up Miro and he says, you know, this disk that these guys from the nuclear power plant gave me is doing something really strange. I think you need to come and have a look. And so they went over and had a look at it together, and yeah, it was doing something really weird. And it turns out that this was actually the discovery of one of the first computer viruses, and they called it Vienna, which then turned out to be a whole family of viruses. And it would look, at the time, it was a very simple thing. It just tried to find other files and overwrite them. But I mean, really, this was, you know, sort of the genesis of cybersecurity and cyber attacks. And so this carries on for a few months, and later they discover another virus, and this time it's more sophisticated, it's got encryption, they're having difficulty analyzing it, and they team up with their friends at the nuclear power plant, and they start looking at it, and they actually realize that they discovered the first boot sector virus, and they actually managed to stop it before it did damage at the nuclear power plant. So in a way, one could argue that this is one of the first energy attacks or energy infrastructure attacks that was thwarted by ESET. So it's kind of at this time that Peter and Miro together realized that this could be a huge deal, and they decided to create one of the first antivirus programs. And they called it NOD32, which is an acronym for a Slovak phrase that means hospital on the edge of the disk. And of course, 32 refers to the 32-bit runtime. And so and this is about 1987, you know, still in communist Czechoslovakia. So that's why officially ESET started in 1992. But, you know, it's quite a courageous thing to start creating a product and distributing it, you know, in a communist state. And it was only later, after the Velvet Revolution and the Velvet separation between Czech Republic and Slovakia, that they then actually formally created this company. And then they brought in a whole bunch of computer science students and refactored it, and they really set out to create one of the best antiviruses in the world, and we believe that they succeeded in that. So yeah, I mean, ESET's been in the game a really long time, and even to this day, 30% of the ESET global staff have worked in the company for 10 years or longer. And I think what's relevant is that, you know, cybercrime is cyclical, and so we've been there from the beginning, we've seen it all. So maybe a tactic that hasn't been around for a decade or two cycles around, and we're ready with the data and the experience to find it. So yeah, it's a cool story.
Yeah. Fascinating. And I guess being under Soviet rule back then has given ESET some really interesting insights into the geopolitical issues around cybersecurity, which are prevalent today. And I'm going to talk a little bit more about that later in the discussion. But give me, Adrian, an idea of the scale of ESET as an organization today. How big are you guys?
Absolutely. So, you know, of course, I represent ESET Southern Africa, and we are the distributor for South Africa and 22 other sub-Saharan countries. But ESET as a global company is a massive company employing over 2,000 people worldwide, you know, 13 R&D offices around the world, over 100 million users of the product. And if you include our partnerships with Google and Intel, TDT technology, effectively we cover more than 1 billion devices. So it really is a really serious player, and number one in the European Union for sure.
All right. So, Adrian, let's talk a little bit about what's happening in the cybersecurity landscape in 2024. I know that last year was a big year for ransomware attacks, especially here in South Africa. We saw a number of high-profile ransomware attacks. Is that a continuing trend in 2024?
Yeah, it is. So it's unfortunate that we don't have access to the latest upcoming threat report that we're going to release in July, but it'll be available soon publicly. But I can speak to what's been happening more recently. So in the previous threat report, we noted about a stable level of activity around ransomware, but there was a particularly interesting case last year, which came in the form of a data breach, and it was an attack. It was a data breach, but it was actually a form of ransomware attack that was then modified to become more of an extortion exercise. So it was a file sharing, a big file sharing app, and I'll leave them unnamed for now, and you can look it up easily. And basically what happened was these guys exploited a vulnerability that they had found for 2 years. They were sitting there, dwelling there for 2 years, and were just waiting for the right time, testing it. And when the time was ready, they launched their attack, and there was so much data that they had access to, instead of encrypting it, which is the common ransomware approach, they actually decided just to steal it. So probably because there was so much data and that it would have been too resource intensive to actually encrypt it all. So they stole it. And now they've got data relating to 2,700 organizations, and we're talking government agencies and schools and healthcare and big companies. So they had a lot of leverage to then go to these organizations and say, well, look, we've got your data, pay up or we'll publish it on the dark web. And some of them paid and some of them didn't. And those that didn't, well, their data's all over the dark web. So this was a really, really huge attack. And the estimated cost of damages was in excess of perhaps $14 billion. And law enforcement estimates, I guess, that the earnings of the attackers was in the region of $100 million. So it was a big deal.
Yeah, yeah. So, Adrian, what are some of the other trends you're seeing this year? I believe that supply chain attacks are on the rise. What are supply chain attacks, and why are the threat actors targeting that area specifically?
Yeah, so supply chain is an attack vector that I think is not that obvious to most people, because we're so accustomed to thinking about our own infrastructure, our own systems, our own networks. But we kind of forget that we don't exist in isolation. So a supply chain attack is really an attack that originates through any entity that's coming from our supply chain. So that could be, you know, it could be something like firmware on devices. It could be through hardware or a hardware supplier. And it can also just be software. Most commonly, it is software. So, you know, most organizations use software provided by other companies. They don't just use their own internal systems. And if there's a vulnerability inside of one of these third-party software that they use, you know, that's a way in for an attacker. And I think there's been two really alarming examples of this that have such immense scale. And the first, I think everyone knows, is the Log4j vulnerability that was about 2 years ago. And what was so alarming about that was that Log4j, because it was so commonly used in the Java coding language, and Java's been around for decades, it was used everywhere because it was used for logging, and logging is something that everyone does. So it had the whole world scrambling to patch that vulnerability. But more recently, which was perhaps equally alarming but not quite as impactful, is the Linux xzutils vulnerability. So that sounds, what is this? So xzutils is an external library that is used for compression in certain variants of Linux. So Linux is an operating system, and there are various different flavors of Linux. We call them distributions. And you might have heard the names like Red Hat or Ubuntu or Debian, things like that. Now, some distributions of Linux use an external package called xzutils. And earlier this year, a vulnerability was discovered in xzutils that effectively would have created a backdoor into a Linux server, like a complete end-to-end, allowing you to escalate privileges and gain complete control, which is hugely alarming because it was through the SSH protocol, which is basically supposed to be a secure way of remotely connecting to Linux servers. And the alarming thing about this is that Linux servers are, it's the most common operating system used on servers, on the internet, on-premise, off-premise, you name it. Mm-hmm. So in terms of its potential impact, it was huge. Why it wasn't as impactful, though, was that we got lucky, because when you have open source software projects, they tend to go through different streams of release. So when an update is done, it first goes into kind of like a beta pre-release stream, if you will. And that gives the community access to the product. They can use it, test it, fix bugs, etc. And it was at this stage that the vulnerability, thankfully, was discovered by a principal engineer at Microsoft and then alerted the open source community, and it could be fixed. So before this reached mainstream adoption and mainstream stable release, it was discovered. And that's why this was such a close shave. But it was still a problem because a lot of people were using, you know, early releases of the affected this affected library. The other thing that helped the situation was that not all distributions of Linux were affected. So only some were affected, not all of them. But if you think about it, if this had made it through, this could have been as impactful as Log4j. And I think the other really interesting thing about this to consider is, again, there was a very long attack timeline to this. So similar to the file transfer app vulnerability that I discussed earlier, which was being exploited for 2 years. This was somebody who joined the open source community for a period of probably about 2 years as well, earned credibility as a contributor to this project. And that's how they then were able to insert a vulnerability. So this was a very long-term plan, strategic potential attack. And it really gives you an idea of just how strategic and committed these and forward-thinking these plans can be. So yeah, quite alarming stuff.
It's very alarming. I mean, the XZ Utils issue, was that discovered because of the fact that this was open source software and the code could be scrutinized by third parties? And can we assume that similar vulnerabilities exist in closed source software that we just can't see because we don't have access to the original source code?
Duncan, yeah, I think the answer is yes to both your questions. So yes, it was discovered because it was open source and there was early access to at least use the product before it was went to mainstream release. But the way it was discovered was not actually because the code was open source. It was actually because the engineer noticed that his SSH connections were suddenly half a second slower than they were before after he did the update. And then he decided to dig into that and he was like, oh my goodness, I've discovered something huge. And your second question is, well, do similar vulnerabilities exist in proprietary software? And the answer is yes, absolutely. I mean, most of the attacks that happen are happening in proprietary software, which is not open source. And it's, these are called zero-day vulnerabilities. So no one knows about them, an attacker finds them and then gets to exploit them until such time as the industry or as some benevolent party can discover them and alert the software firm and they can issue a patch for it.
And of course, the world's cloud infrastructure largely runs on these Linux servers, and a vulnerability like this could have been devastating potentially.
Absolutely, and that's why this idea of supply chain attacks is such an important one that sneaks up on us, because we often assume that if we're using cloud infrastructure or cloud-based applications, we effectively place our trust in these entities, in these companies that either create the infrastructure or the applications. And a supply chain attack takes advantage of that trust. And we can't necessarily assume that these external parties that we are trusting, whether they mean to or not, are doing all the right things. Most of them are trying to. Most of them know that it's in their interest to have the best security and do all the right practices. But the thing is about cybersecurity is that it's complex. And the reason zero-day vulnerabilities exist at all is due to this complexity. It's really hard to find and plug all the possible holes, especially in complex infrastructure or complex software applications.
What are some of the other trends you're seeing this year? There was a lot of talk about the potential for deep fakes and AI to be misused in the South African election. Thankfully, it doesn't seem to have happened at sort of any sort of scale that I've seen. But deep fakes, I mean, is that an area that ESET is watching closely? What are you seeing in that area in 2024?
Absolutely. We're definitely watching it really closely, and it's a rising problem. So, you know, of course, this comes from the technology area of generative AI, as we know, which has become very mainstream. And there's lots of technologies out there that can generate written content or generate photo or video content as well. And this kind of technology can be used for malicious intent. So I love to talk about the stories that one of our global researchers based in the UK office, Jake Moore, talks about, because he does a lot of this himself. He does little experiments, and they're harmless because he does them with the consent of the parties involved. But he uses these experiments to, first of all, they make for great conference talks. But secondly, they really are very effective at demonstrating the power of this technology and how it can be misused. So the last time I spoke to him, he told me the story about how he often plays these experiments with friends, and he's running out of friends, frankly, to play these tricks on. But he'll go up to a friend, usually a business owner, and he'll be like, look, can I do this? Can I try and break into your business or extort money from you or something? And he'll get their full consent. It's all very above board. And he gets the go ahead, and then he'll try something. So this time what he did was he met up with his friend in full visibility of his friend, cloned, using a device that I won't mention, cloned the RFID office security card that his friend who owns the business has. So now he has a cloned RFID card that gives him access to the office. And he says to his friend, I bet you I can get into your office and avoid all your security. And his friend says, no way. And so within a day, he was sitting there in his friend's office in the boardroom. No one had noticed. It was three taps of a security card. And he even asked an employee walking past the boardroom to take a photograph of him sitting in the boardroom. And it's a hysterical photo of him lying, you know, with his hands behind his ears, feet up on the boardroom table. Everyone's none the wiser. And that was really easy and really surprising to his friend, the owner of the business, who said, yeah, but I've got CCTV. And he says, well, I have taken your CCTV footage and modified it. So there's no record that I was ever here. And what he did was, and I've seen the footage myself, he generated a fake face and then used a face swap technology to swap the face of him in the CCTV technology. And he literally walks right up to the camera and puts his face right in the camera. And when you see the modified footage, it's amazing. It looks absolutely realistic and it doesn't look like him at all. So that was phase one. And then the second part of the story, which gets more alarming, is he thought to himself, well, how can I now monetize this? You know, this has all been fun, but I haven't actually done anything of value from an attacker's point of view. So what he did was he hacked into this friend's LinkedIn account. And now for context, this friend of his is known for being a cycling enthusiast. This is a serious hobby at an almost professional level, let's say. So, you know, he's got a cycling team and this is something he takes very seriously. So what Jake did was he created a fake video using previous footage of his friend from previous cycling tours and exercise that they'd done. And the video looks exactly like this guy, and it's of him talking and saying, and you've got like his team in the background packing up bikes, and they're somewhere in Tenerife, and he says, I've decided I'm going to cycle from the UK to Australia. And he posts this on LinkedIn. And within a day, it's got 4,000 views, comments start streaming in, people are believing it. I mean, some people maybe thought he was joking, because it's quite an outrageous thing to suggest, you know, cycle to Australia. But the point is that they believed it was this guy actually saying it, whether it was a joke or not. But more alarmingly, he started getting comments saying from companies saying, we'll be your sole sponsor. People were offering up donations. So there was a very clear monetization trend. It pretty much fooled everyone. And the only person that it didn't fool was this person's 14-year-old daughter who said, nope, that's not my father. But everyone else was completely fooled. So this is an amusing anecdote, and it's harmless. Obviously, no one was harmed. But really, how does this actually manifest in the real world? And the truth is that it can happen in the real world. And there was a huge example of this earlier this year, where a large UK-based engineering firm paid $25 million to a malicious actor's bank account. And how they did this was they used deepfake technology to create a fake Zoom call and impersonate the CFO. So they impersonated the CFO and, to add credibility to the exercise, impersonated other staff members. So they create this fake Zoom call, and then they asked, obviously they created some kind of pretense for the money transfers, and they asked somebody in the organization who had the requisite authority to make the payments. And I think they got as far as 15 payments to 5 different bank accounts in Hong Kong before the organization realized, hang on, this is not right. So $25 million. So wow. That's a huge success story from an attacker's point of view.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let's dive into the impact of AI on the cybersecurity landscape in some more detail, because I mean it is the technology that everyone is talking about this year. Let's start talking about the downsides of AI and what threat actors are going to be able to do with this technology. I mean, you've alluded to some of it here, but we use here at Tech Central, we're using generative AI tools on a daily basis now, mainly for image generation, and it's very exciting technology. But I can imagine putting this stuff in the hands of bad guys is going to allow them to do all sorts of things that they haven't done in the past. What sort of ways are you seeing threat actors using AI technologies to attack their victims? What are they doing with it, and how do you expect that's going to expand in the coming years?
Yeah, so Duncan, I think it's always important to take a step back and recognize that AI has been going through a huge hype cycle in the last 18 months. Pretty much since ChatGPT became public is when it all started. And so most people, when they think AI, they are thinking about generative AI. Of course, AI is an umbrella term that encompasses not only generative AI, but other AI technologies such as machine learning and neural networks and things like that. And they're all relevant in cybersecurity. But we can talk a little bit more about generative AI. And I think the problem at the moment is that you've kind of got two camps who are either characterizing it as an upcoming doomsday scenario, or the opposite, which is, you know, the solution to all our problems. And the truth is that it's actually neither. It's more like the advent of computers or the advent of the internet. It is a new technology, and as a society, we're still learning how it's going to change our lives and how we need to adapt to it. The biggest difference, and why we should be paying such close attention to it, is that the pace of advancement is so much faster than any of these prior paradigm shifts. So let's talk about specifically how it's affecting cybersecurity. Look, despite speculations, at the moment, as far as we know, artificial general intelligence doesn't exist. So there's no all-knowing, self-learning, making decisions on its own technology that represents a supreme threat or a silver bullet in terms of attacking or defending. It's much more still in the assistive realm, and it's really an efficiency play. So all the ways in which it helps us and harms us in cybersecurity is all around efficiency, and it really is often around content and content generation. So from an attacker point of view, it can greatly accelerate things like the creation of spam or phishing content or disinformation. So at great scale and at great speed, you can, anything that requires content generation, you know, which spam and phishing content does, you can now do that with perfect grammar, or you can mimic somebody's writing style. You can really, you know, improve the credibility or the degree to which it's convincing. You can also accelerate the spread of disinformation, because you can rewrite articles really easily and insert falsehoods, insert fake images, fake videos, things like that. So there's a huge scale efficiency effect from a content creation perspective, and that shouldn't be underestimated, because most cybersecurity attacks outside of vulnerabilities come from phishing. And we don't need to talk about the harm that disinformation can do in the world as well. Moving on, evading detection is another way that AI harms our cybersecurity. So the ESET Global Research Team actually have direct experience with this. They were trying to take a closer look at the Emotet botnet, which is quite a prolific botnet, and they were noticing that every time they got access to have a look, they were getting blocked, and getting blocked quickly. And what they realized was that these guys must have been using some kind of machine learning algorithm to detect their monitoring attempts and then quickly block them. This would be a very slow and difficult process to do manually, but with a sophisticated machine learning algorithm, you can do it really quickly. So that's one way that cyber attackers can protect malicious infrastructure. Another thing that we can do is writing new malware. Now, the thing about Gen AI's ability to write malware is it's still quite limited and weak. Now, of course, at the moment, this is the worst it's ever going to be. It's only going to get better. But at the moment, if you say to it from scratch, write me sophisticated malware, it's not going to do a good job. But it's still a huge efficiency driver. So if you give it a narrow task, a parameterized task, like debug this code or optimize this code or rewrite this library in another coding language, things like that, or maybe slightly modify this existing script to evade detection. It's really good at those kinds of things. So again, there's this highly assistive and improvement in efficiency that it adds to cyber attacks. But yeah, complex malware, we're not quite there yet. Human ingenuity still has the edge in that. But even if it did have the ability to write sophisticated malware, malware on its own is not the only thing that is required for a end-to-end attack to be successful. A cyber attack is actually a series of different components and steps that are then strung together and need to be architected. You have to have a distribution, a strategy. You have to avoid detection of security products and personnel. You need a monetization strategy. You need to facilitate communication with the victim in order to extract the monetization. And all of this GenAI can be helpful for, but it cannot architect and execute the entire thing. So at the moment, it's an assistive technology, but it's not this end-to-end threat. So in terms of looking at, you know, you asked about the future and what we might anticipate in future. Well, what we're expecting is that AI can be used to plant false flags. And what I mean by that is often threat researchers will look at activity and then they will want to assign, yes, attribute that activity to an activity group so they can track who's doing what and where. And if AI can really, you know, take published threat information and be like, okay, well, the signature characteristics of this group are X, Y, and Z, then they can plant those in their activities and make it look like actually this attack was done by that group. Meanwhile, it's actually done by this other group. So it's a form of obfuscation that it can facilitate. Improved victim selection is another thing. So we spoke earlier about a data breach, and there's been some really big data breaches. So we can kind of assume that a lot of our data is out there, whether we want it to or not. That's just how the world, where the world has come to. But the problem with these data breaches is that it's such a large amount of information. And what AI can help with is that it can analyze that information and then propose or maybe do like a victim profiling exercise and say, well, here are the most vulnerable victims based on the data available. And that kind of shortlisting, if you will, it would be a mammoth task for a human to do, but much quicker and easier with AI. And then, you know, a cyber attack can be like, okay, cool, I've got my shortlist of particularly vulnerable victims. I'm going to take all the information available and launch, I don't know, a spear phishing attack or something like that. Mm-hmm. And then finally, there is hunting for vulnerabilities. So we've already spoken about the importance about vulnerabilities and just how easily they can be exploited to such a large degree. And we do believe that AIs can be trained in future to search or scan or find vulnerabilities. And that could offer a huge advantage to cyber attackers if they have a technology that's automating the discovery of vulnerabilities, especially zero-day ones, as opposed to them being discovered through the manual exploration of curious techies.
I was going to ask whether we're heading into a future where malware is self-learning, is able to, you know, if it encounters an issue trying to attack or break into a system, it can learn new ways of breaking into systems and can start to modify itself so that it becomes more capable of breaking defenses. How far are we away from a world like that, if we're ever going to get there? Is that a real risk?
I think it is a material risk to consider. I can't really offer a prediction about how far away we are from that kind of self-aware malware. That really speaks to the more AGI, artificial general intelligence, type of technology. However, what we do see at the moment is there is malware that is that can kind of self-obfuscate. So it can learn when it's being detected, and there are somewhat rudimentary ways in which it can adapt its behavior to avoid detection. It can maybe emulate something or simulate something that's a legitimate process and you know, do things like that. So we are some of the way there, but an entirely self-evolving form of malware, we're not aware of that at the moment. It's a possibility in the future, and we'll definitely be keeping an eye out for that.
And out of interest, do you think AI is going to make it easier for non-technical people to try and attack systems and penetrate vulnerable company systems? I mean, we saw the emergence of so-called script kiddies at one point, and it, you know, it became much easier for even for non-technical people to play around with these tools and do stuff with them. Do you think AI is going to make or encourage more people to enter into the world of cybercrime?
It's a great question, Duncan. And I think the answer is yes. Maybe if we go back a bit and we say, well, you know, you could ask the same question of the internet. You know, the internet really was the first paradigm shift in democratizing information, and certainly information about how technology, computers, and systems work. And, you know, that was the first, you know, outside of computer clubs in the 80s in communist Czechoslovakia, you know, the internet was this huge game changer that allows the whole world to connect and learn. And certainly you can learn for malicious intent. And I think Gen AI does simplify that even more and make it more accessible, because Gen AI, especially large language models, are particularly good as acting as teachers. So you can ask it a question, how do I do this? Or write me a script to do that. So it definitely does make it more accessible. I will say, though, that despite that, you know, there's an equally increasing sophistication in security defenses. So whilst I do think that Gen AI can be used as a way to technically upskill oneself, I don't think that necessarily a non-technical layperson can suddenly become an expert in cyber attacks. You know, with the current state of large language models, you know, it can write code, but often it's suboptimal code, or it's not that good. Might have mistakes in it, and if you don't have the technical know-how to identify that, you know, you're still at a disadvantage. So, I think the answer is yes, but with limitations.
Okay, I wanted to bring the discussion back to the geopolitics that's happening in the world right now. The world is in a quite a parlous state, if I can put it that way. We've obviously had Russia's invasion of Ukraine, and we know the Russians have historically engaged quite actively in attacking systems and attacking other countries' systems. We know they've got a large population of highly technically skilled people working in inverted commas in the cybercrime space. Do you see nation states starting to employ AI tools as well in their attacks?
Yeah, certainly. So I think, you know, just to talk about geopolitical attacks, sure, they're all about motive. So I think it's important that we make this distinction when it comes to nation state or state-sponsored attacks versus attacks from private individuals. So the implication of a geopolitical attack is that the motivation is different. In other words, it's based on the motivation is towards a political outcome as opposed to financial gain. But even within geopolitical attacks, we can differentiate again between nation state and state-sponsored attacks and geopolitically motivated private groups. So if we look at the conflict between Russia and Ukraine, so let me answer your first question, which was, well, are we seeing the use of AI? I think the assumption is yes. You know, we should assume that all the things that I've discussed so far about how AI can be used, those are being used across the board, whether it's a nation state attack or a private attack. So those are the latest tools of the trade in terms of attacks, and those are definitely being used. When it comes to actual looking at geopolitical attacks of nature, it's interesting to look at the coordination and what they actually do in terms of what they go after. So, for example, the day before the conflict between Ukraine and Russia began, ESET research actually found malware, three different forms of the same wiper malware, trying to be installed on various Ukrainian institutions. And the idea was they were trying to undermine the functioning of these public institutions. And then, of course, the next day there was military action from Russia. And if you look at the timestamp of the creation of this malware that was discovered, it goes back to late December 2021. So the inference that we make from this is that, you know, this was part of a pre-planned, coordinated military and cyber attack that Russia had planned, which, you know, kickstarted the conflict. And there's an APT group called Sandworm, and they are known to be associated or believed to be associated with Russian GRU, which is Russian military intelligence. And shortly after the conflict began, they then tried to attack electricity supply infrastructure in Ukraine using an updated version of the InDestroyer malware. Now, there's history behind this, because InDestroyer is what they used against Ukraine a couple of years earlier and actually succeeded. And they took power offline for about an hour. But this time, with coordination between Ukraine and their various institutions and the ESET research team, Sandworm were not able to succeed at all in attacking or achieving a power outage, which is quite a win. Now, I think the other thing that we noticed in the months after after the conflict began was that a huge uptick in ransomware telemetry targeted against Russia. And as you alluded to earlier, often, you know, we find these kinds of attacks are coming from Russia, but actually this was a kind of form of hacktivism, if you will. In other words, it was a private response to this conflict initiated by Russia. And actually suddenly Russia found itself being, the target of whoever, you know, a large group of private individuals or private APT groups who strongly disagreed with their actions and were, you know, trying to bring Russia down. So it's really an illustration of kind of how geopolitics can inform these activities. And more recently, we find that Sandworm, the APT group, is still targeting Ukrainian energy supply infrastructure. And again, if you look at the military actions that Russia is taking against energy supply infrastructure in Ukraine, it's definitely, again, it stands to reason that there's this trend that it's correlated and it's part of a coordinated attack. The final comment I'll make about, you know, another form of geopolitical or geopolitically motivated attack is that of disinformation. So we found a lot of evidence of these spam campaigns that were targeted against Ukrainians, and the goal was to try and demoralize the Ukrainian public. So what they would do is they would impersonate Ukrainian officials and send messages saying things like, for the upcoming winter, we are expecting major disruptions in heating. We're expecting shortages of food, medication. And the whole idea is to try and demoralize the public. But it's not just Ukraine who's on the receiving end of this. The Russians were on the receiving end of it as well. There was a protest against Putin, which was disrupted by a similar kind of disinformation campaign, you know, which was spreading false information around the camp, around when the protest was happening and things like that. So, you know, I think what's important here is that there's a lot of activity around geopolitics. They are using these AI tactics. You know, all of this disinformation is likely AI generated, especially when it comes to translated content. And the truth is that most established governments in the world are using these tactics. You know, we're just using the Russia-Ukraine conflict as an example because that's where most of the telemetry and data is that we have. And, you know, it's a political context where there's a mainstream understanding, but it's pervasive across the world.
It's fascinating that these sort of nation-state cyber attacks could actually be a precursor and almost a predictor of actual conflict to come, that in future perhaps conflicts will be fought online in the months prior to a hot war breaking out.
Absolutely.
Do you think that's a fair observation? And do you think that that where we see spikes in the sort of activity could actually be an indicator that that actual physical conflict may follow?
For sure. I mean, I think it definitely could be a potential precursor. You know, we can look at activity with groups that are aligned to, you know, certain countries and where we know that there are rising tensions. And it certainly could be taken as a precursor. But the truth is it could be before, during, or even after military or more physical forms of attack. So I think it's a fair observation. And it's certainly why threat intelligence and keeping an eye on this kind of APT activity is so important for sure.
Yeah. I'd like to steer the conversation as we move to the end of the conversation today, Adrian, back to AI, and I'd like to look at the good that it could potentially bring to the cybersecurity industry. How do you see AI helping security vendors like ESET fight the scourge of cybercrime going forward?
Yeah, absolutely, Duncan. So it's a really useful tool as well for the defenders, the defense side of things. I will say, though, that we must always keep in mind that AI alone is not the silver bullet. And, you know, some vendors would have you believe that an AI alone or a very AI-centric or AI-forward product is the answer. And it's a little bit misleading in our opinion. AI is a fantastic defensive technology, but any AI model, if left unsupervised, will degenerate. And, I mean, we've seen lots of examples. There have been some quite amusing and alarming recent examples in the media of large language model chatbots doing some outrageous hallucinations. They're all over the internet. And, you know, so it happens in chatbots, in Gen AI, it happens in machine learning. all AI models left unsupervised typically will degenerate. So the point I'm trying to make is that AI is an extra defensive layer that we have. And now with Gen AI, we have yet another defensive layer that we can use. And so I can describe how we can use it. But what's really important is that whether it's generative AI or machine learning or whichever of your chosen AI technology is, if it's not combined with other layers of defense and really good training data sets and the supervision and expertise of humans, it's not going to be very good. And the reason is because it will give you tons of false positives. And a false positive can sometimes be as bad as a cyber attack. If a false positive brings your whole organization to a halt, it can do as much damage, you know, to an organization as an attack. So that's really important just to keep in mind. But let's talk more specifically about AI, and let's say generative AI can be used to help us. So one of the main things it can do is it can help explain threat intelligence. So we have a threat intelligence offering, lots of vendors do. And often it is a large, complex, very technical data set. And one thing that Gen AI can be really good at is to take a highly technical subject matter and then translate that or distill it into something that is summarized and maybe more understandable by somebody who is non-technical, like an executive. So the interpretation and summarization of large amounts of threat data is one way that Gen AI can be really useful. We can also create in-product AI assistants. So one big way that attacks happen is the misconfiguration of systems and security products. And one thing we can create is an AI assistant that can perhaps identify those misconfigurations and make suggestions as to steps to mitigate. We could also use this AI assistant to start executing maybe basic things, but things that would take several manual steps, like changing a firewall rule. And you can just use a natural language prompt and say, please update this rule, you know, with these parameters, and it can just go ahead and do it. So that's a way that it can make us more efficient in defense. AI can also be used to help SOC teams or security teams who have this ever-expanding challenge where the attack surface seems to always be increasing and they have tons of threat intelligence data. They've got lots of alerts from their XDR products. And how do you make sense of this? How do you prioritize? How do you know what to focus on? And Gen AI can do a great job of helping us prioritize what to focus on. It can place activities into context, can help us with interpretation, and really help direct focus to the things that most need our attention. It can also do things like string together historically correlated events, which can be very helpful in post-incident investigations as well, which is an equally important part of cybersecurity, because if you don't learn from your incidents, then you can't improve. And finally, you know, there are things like boosting user awareness. And again, this harks back to the educational teaching element of large language models. User awareness is probably one of the biggest tools we have in cybersecurity. And it's also one of the hardest attack vectors to solve. Unfortunately, people are the weakest link. So Gen AI can do a ton of things. It can ingest media articles and translate those into internal memos to create awareness. You can create phishing campaigns to test your organization's, you know, sensitivity and awareness to phishing attempts, create quizzes, educational content, things like that. We can also use it to augment sandbox analysis. So we've been doing cloud sandbox analysis for years now, and we have very sophisticated machine learning algorithms. And now we can add an extra layer on top of that, which is Gen AI, and it can do things like interpret the content of a screenshot or look at basic events like Windows registry changes and can start help to add to the explainability and capability of an unknown potentially malicious piece of software. So there are a ton of things that we can do. So it really is, as much as there are new risks and threats that come from this technology, there are new tools that we can use again from it as well. And that definitely serves to add some comfort. But I'll just mention again that AI alone is not going to cut it, because attackers are always adapting. Behind AI and the AI tools of attacks are really clever, adaptive, ingenious humans. And as they adapt, AI models need to adapt. And at the current state of the technology, AI still needs guidance to adapt. So we need that human expertise. We need that human experience to really get the best out of AI from a defense point of view. And I think ESET's got a really good core competency in that aspect.
If anyone wants to learn more about ESET, what's the website, Adrian?
ESET.com/ZA would be our local website. And yeah, all the information's there.
Excellent. Well, this has been a fascinating discussion. I think there's plenty for the Tech Central audience to chew over here. Adrian Stanford is a group CTO at ESET Southern Africa. Thank you so much for spending the time with us this afternoon and giving us insights into the cybersecurity industry. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Duncan.